LL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and coffee bar. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And we're also very happy to welcome back to the program Mae Barenbaum. She is professor of entomology at University of Illinois. She's head of the Department of Entomology. She is a scientist who studies insects. And on this program now for lo these many years, she has been stopping by so that we could talk about them. The kind of warning I always issue at the beginning of the program when Mae is here is to say that when she is here, we try to stay away from extermination questions. We have a guy for that, Phil Nixon, who, and I really want to say that Phil is a great guy, and he also got into entomology, I think, because he loves insects, not because he wanted to rid the earth of them. It just happens to be his thing, you know, control of insects, although he's always been very good about saying, well, first of all, decide, can you live with this thing? And if you can, fine. And if not, well, okay, we can help you out with that. Anyway, he's not here. Sometime soon, probably he'll be back on the show. And if you have a problem with an insect, you need to get rid of it, he's the guy to talk to because that's his specialty. When Mae is on the program, we do something different. And the idea is that we try to appreciate insects for all of the interesting ways that they go about making their lives. And so if you want to ask a question, maybe you have seen some insect and you're not sure what it is, and you're hoping maybe she can tell you. Well, call in and give us the best description you can, and she will try and do that. Other sorts of questions about bugs and how they live their lives are certainly welcome. She's written many scientific papers and is known, very well known in her field. She has also written books for people who are not scientists, and you can go to the bookstore and look for them, but let me just mention 99 Gnats, Nits, and Nibblers and 99 more Maggots, Mites, and Munchers. They're both published by the U of I Press, or another book that looks at insects and how it is they intersect, how their lives intersect with ours. That's a book that's titled Bugs in the System, Insects and Their Impact on Human Affairs. So if you'd like to read about insects, there are a couple. And as I said, you know, go down to the bookstore and look in that section. Look for Barenbaum and you'll find some of her work. And here on the program, your questions are certainly welcome, too. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. Well, it's good to have you here once again.
Always good to be here.
I think, was it the last time when you were here to talk about the film festival?
I think so.
So that would have been in a long time back ago. Oh, well. Anyway, we're glad to have you here.
I should say there. The book called Bugs in the System, there is another book titled Bugs in the System, which you can find in your computer section of the, it's about software.
Oh, so it's a different kind
of
bug.
Yeah, don't pick that one up.
So. Okay. Look for Mae Barenbaum. I don't know who the other person is, but we'll save that for another day. We have some folks here ready to go, and so let's talk with them. We'll start in Champaign and line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I have two questions, basically. The first one was that we noticed in a post in our yard about a pencil eraser size hole with sawdust below it. Then later, my daughter saw a bee flying into it, which I gather was a carpenter bee. But what surprised me was that this was a pressure-treated post, and I didn't think that they could handle that.
Oh, pressure-treated meaning it's injected into it various sorts of preservatives?
Noxious chemicals and preservatives, but apparently it was able to bore right into it.
Well, it kind of depends in large part on what's been pumped in there, because if it, for whatever reason, wears away or if it doesn't penetrate all the way through, it's not going to stop them. Often what's pumped in is to prevent mold or decay, and that doesn't have specifically insecticidal properties. I know they've used arsenicals, you know, arsenic-containing compounds, which is pretty much inimical to life.
Yes.
But those are being phased out. So the downside of, well, the upside of not having arsenicals, you don't have to worry about your kids having degenerative nerve diseases. But the upside is that, that's the upside. The downside is that it's not as broad spectrum as it might be. They're very good at tunneling through all kinds of things. They've found some of these bees tunneling through masonry, actually. So they're really determined to get in there.
Okay, the other thing was that every so often during the year, in long cracks in concrete pavement and so on, there'll be colonies of these tiny little brown ants that are bringing up their little mounds of dirt, but then they go away. Could you talk about these ants and what they're doing when you don't see them most of the year?
So this is, where do you see these guys?
Typically, in pavement, along cracks in the pavement or along steps.
Well, there's actually an ant called the pavement ant, so that might be what you're seeing.
And they're very tiny.
The very, very tiniest ants that I'm aware of around here, and ants are tough. Ants are really hard to tell apart. The very tiny ones are like, they're called pharaoh ants, and they are extremely small. Pavement ants are a little bit bigger. They're about a tenth of an inch, if you consider that big. But you tend to see them, you know, in lawns, underneath stones, and paving, at the edges of pavement and the like. And they can get into houses through crevices.
They're most prominent along the pavement, I guess, because there's less debris and so on to hide them. But that's where I notice them. And
right.
They have little brown mounds distributed along the cracks.
Right. That's your typical sort of habit of the pavement ant, which is Tetramorium cespitum. And these guys, you don't see them because they live a subterranean existence. It's, the mound is basically their, you know, entrance and exit, and all the activity goes on underground where they're a lot safer. So if there's any kind of disturbance to the integrity of the nest, they'll move the nest elsewhere, which is when you see them actually above ground. So, and they'll go foraging and the like.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks. So if you, I've had this experience, I'm sure a lot of have experience, just walking along and suddenly coming on a swarm, an enormous number of these ants, really small ones. They look like they're brown, brown ants.
Well, yeah, it says the Tetramorium is brown.
Okay. So I guess we're talking about the pavement ant. And it does seem to be around either on the edges of sidewalk, and you see these huge numbers of them. And you wonder, well, what are they? So they're moving?
Yeah. Well, if there's any disturbance, they'll go and find a new place. And, there's some ants pick the strangest places. There's I think it's the odorous house ant is one that you sometimes find in mailboxes, which you'd think would be a really bad place. I mean, in terms of avoiding disturbance, I don't know about you, I get a whole slew of catalogs every day.
So every time
it's opened and closed, there's a disturbance to the nest. So nests are sometimes very movable or very not so movable. It depends on the species of ant and the size of the colony and what else is going on. I mean, there's some ants whose nests fit into a single acorn. That's the whole nest, everybody, you know, larvae and adults and pupae and eggs and the like. And others like, the famed fire ant, which can be, you know, many, many feet in extent. Same thing with the leafcutter ants. They're just enormous, huge, many feet across and hundreds of tunnels underground, chambers underground. So they run the gamut. And not bad for something that's, you know, a tenth of an inch long. And those are not that small, actually, because the tiny, tiny ants, like the pharaoh ant and what's called aptly the little black ant, they're about 5/100, 6/100 of an inch, which is kind of hard to even compare to anything.
How many species of ant are there?
Ooh. How many species of ants? Let me think, or let me cheat and read this. I'm not sure.
It's lots. Not a quiz. I mean, we're talking about thousands?
Thousands, yeah, definitely thousands. It's a family unto itself. It's one of the easiest families of all insects to recognize. You know, talk about family resemblances. All ants have those sort of jauntily bent antennae. You know, that's a real classic. And then that funny little waist, which is all wasps and bees have a wasp waist, but the ant has sort of an extra narrow constriction. And it just gives them this ant-like look that's kind of unlike just about anything else, even their close relatives.
And is it still true that some people suspect that there are species of ants that have not yet been identified?
Oh, absolutely.
So there are question. All kinds of ants out there living out there that nobody has come along and said, okay, this is a different one from all the others, and it doesn't have a name, and so we're going to give it a name.
Oh, yeah. There's any group of insects. There's tons. There's no question. In fact, I'm sure I've told the listeners the story of the weevil that I discovered that was not known to science. Have I told this story on the air?
You probably have. No, yeah. I don't recall.
Reruns in the summer.
Barenbaum's weevil?
Well, that was the problem. It's a tiny little weevil that lives in the flower heads of a plant in the carrot family, a native weed. And I found it on this, not a native weed, a wildflower. And I couldn't identify it, so I sent it to an expert in the U.S. National Museum in this particular group of weevils, the Cuculeanid weevils. And he identified it in the genus Apion, which has about 700 species in it. But it was a new species. And I was afraid he'd describe it and name it after me. And the reason I was afraid of that is this is a weevil whose, you know, weevils are characterized by this elongate nose. They have this proboscis.
Yes.
So all I need is a weevil whose nose is half the length of its body to be known as Barenbaum's weevil. I'm already sensitive enough about that, so I don't need that. It turned out he never did describe it, so it's still unknown to science.
Okay, but if you discover something, you get to name it?
No, well, yeah, but you can't name it after yourself. There's a whole elaborate series of rules about how you name things. You can't name it after yourself. You can't name it anything that's obscene. You can't. Really, anything in bad taste is subject to... A lot of entomologists slipped some things through.
Well, if it's Latin, who's going to know?
Well, there's a whole group of people who specialize in translating potential obscenities from the Latin to back to English. So.
All right. May Barenbaum is our guest here, the discoverer of the weevil that does not bear her name, not known as Barenbaum's weevil. And if you have questions about insects, you can give us a call. She's professor and head of entomology here at U of I, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Caller in Salem is next, and it's line 4. Hello.
Hi, I'm so glad you have me on because last week I came across an insect that looks similar to an ant with really longer, thinner legs, almost looked like a spider, but it had a red abdomen that was not the hairy one. It was like a teardrop shape, and it had a long proboscis, and it stung my shoulder, really hurt.
And it wasn't furry?
It was not furry. It wasn't one of those red...
Velvet ants?
Velvet ants, no.
Yeah, that would have been my guess, because they're often red.
I've never seen one like it. And
no wings?
I just threw it away. I had a star thinking, she won't be on for a long time. But my husband found another one out in the yard. We've never seen them before. I looked up in my golden guide and couldn't find anything.
Now, the wings... are kind of key here, because if it's wingless, then that narrows things down considerably, and it may well have been just another kind of ant. You don't happen to notice if its antennae had an elbow shape to them?
No. We threw it away, but it did have a long snout.
That's kind of unusual for a...
And it's the body, the back end, the back end, part of the body was teardrop shaped, but it was bright red.
Yeah, that one, and it bit you.
Yes, and I was just sitting in the dining room. I had been working outside, so it might have caught in my hair or something, but I had short sleeves on, and it bit the top of my shoulder really hard. And I swatted it off, and at first I thought it was a spider, but my husband counted the legs, and it was only six.
And was there a really, really thin waist, or was it kind
very
of a chunky?
Very thin waist, very thin. You see these machines that spray the fields that sit up really high, these machines they have that put the herbicides down.
Uh-huh.
It looked like an ant up on one of those things, but very thin, not as even thick as an ant.
Well, there's if it was winged, there are... wasps called mud daubers that have really, really thin abdomen, well, thin connections to the thorax and then a teardrop-shaped abdomen. And they can be brightly, have abdomens that are brightly colored. They don't normally bite, though. They would
sting. I know what a mud dauber looks like.
Okay, it's not.
A very bright red.
Oh, this is something I... And... Well,
so if I can't find another one like that...
Yeah, send it in. Now, there's a lot of things with and quite, can't, you know, sort of conspicuous mouth parts that bite. Some of the true bugs will bite. Mm-hmm. But they don't have that waist. They're kind of chunky, I guess. I can't remember what the body, you know, they're not, they're apples or pears. They're not wasps. So,
mm-hmm.
But if it looked like an ant, that would mean it had a constricted waist, and that would pretty much make it a hymenopteran. And that's that the order of bees, ants, and wasps.
Or a wasp, right?
Yeah. Uh huh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll if you could find another one, that would be great.
Most unusual thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, because mostly the hymenopterans.
And I kept it for over a week now, and then it was in a canning jar, and I needed to use the jar, so I threw it out.
Oh, just mail it in if you can find a container, like a pill, you know, empty pill container or something.
Mm-hmm.
Just mail it on in, and we're happy to take a look at it.
And in your book, do you have what kind of insects? Are they pitchers or?
No. Well, there's. In the 99 books, there's kind of cartoon-like sketches. It's not really an identification guide.
Okay.
But there, you know, the it's amazing what you can find on the web. It is truly incredible. What if you go to Google image search,
mm-hmm.
You can find just even with a few, if you get it down to the order, you can maybe look it up with a picture. If you send me an email with a description, I can go do a web search, see what I can find for you.
Okay, well, thank you, and I enjoy listening to that talk anyway.
Well, sorry, I couldn't. This one is a real puzzle. The teardrop is kind of diagnostic. It should leap out immediately, but things I know with teardrops don't have conspicuous mouth parts. So maybe.
Okay.
Oh, thank you very much.
Find another one.
Yeah,
great.
Find another one.
Yeah,
thank
don't
you.
Get bit, don't get bitten, though.
No, it really, really, really hurt.
Wow.
And I get stung by bees and things, doesn't bother me. And this one left like a swollen area. For
wow. Me. There's mited flies. They have a bright band, but no teardrop shape.
No.
Huh, well, that's
and
a
like a hard abdomen, too.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a puzzle.
Well, thank you. I'll let someone else call
okay,
you.
Well,
thank
thanks
you.
For the call.
Bye.
Anytime that somebody does have an insect that they are not sure what it is, if they want an identification, if they can get one, they can always send it to whoever is the extension office closest to them. And if they can't identify it, then they send it to Phil.
Right.
And he identifies it. So there is, if you can get one, that it is possible to get an identification if you really want to know. And, of course, if you want it sent, I hesitate to say that because I'm thinking now a truck's going to come to the station here and it's going to be loaded with dead insects. But if we had something like that, we would certainly pass it on to May or Phil or somebody. And we'd get an identification for you. Let's go to Urbana, next caller, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Japanese beetle. Could you give me a description of its life cycle, its general behavior, and its geographical spread, past, present, and future, and the possible effect of climate change?
Ah, very good questions all. Well, Japanese beetle, Papilio japonica, is, as the name suggests, native to Asia. And it's a member of the Scarabaeae, the scarab family. Among its relatives is included the sacred scarab, which was worshipped by the ancient Egyptians. Needless to say, nobody is worshipping the Japanese beetle now. It's like a lot of the scarabs and its close relatives. They have this really distinctive sort of fan-like terminal end of their antennae. The immature stages live underground. In the case of the scarabs of the Japanese beetles, they feed on grass roots, and they're very fussy. They feed, you know, they don't feed on everything underground, just grass roots, and they will spend the summer, fall, and spring making ugly patches in your lawn. Until just about right now, they'll pupate underground and then emerge as adults. And the adults have habits that are very, very different from kids. You know, kids often are very fussy and adults will eat anything. Well, that's pretty much the life of the Japanese beetle. The adults, unlike some insects that don't even feed as adults, these guys will eat foliage of a tremendous variety of plants, couple of hundred, 300 or so species of plants have been recorded as hosts. They have their favorites among those. You've probably noticed if you have roses or linden trees or some other sorts of trees are particularly vulnerable. Grapevines are really vulnerable. And they engage in a behavior called skeletonizing. So they'll eat all the juicy, tender parts of leaves and leave the coarse, stringy veins behind. When they come out, they'll aggregate. They have a pheromone, and plant damage actually makes the pheromone more effective. So where you get one Japanese beetle, you get lots of Japanese beetles. That's really typical. Let's see. They first arrived here in the U.S. around 1916, just south of New York. They came in probably on roots of nursery trees that, you know, where you bag them in soil, and there were probably some grubs in the soil. And since then, they have been relentlessly making their way west. I grew up in the Northeast in a suburb of Philadelphia, and one of my jobs when I was a kid was picking the Japanese beetles off the grapevines. I moved out here in 1980. Nobody had ever seen one out here. And within the last 5 to 10 years, they've made it out to central Illinois, where they have made themselves most unwelcome, feeding on, among other things, soybeans. They'll feed on the foliage of soybeans. Whether global climate change is accelerating this spread, it's always hard to tell, but it's certainly not out of the realm of possibility that it would move them along more quickly than they would otherwise manage to get across the country. So, yeah, nobody's figured out how to get rid of them. There used to be a quarantine line around the northeastern states, and it just never really worked very well. And they're relentlessly expanding their range. So,
have they moved south or north?
There's a limit to how far south they go, also, how far north? I can't give you. I'm sure they are throughout Illinois, but how far north of that? That's an interesting question. The national expert on Japanese beetles is in Kentucky, which is kind of prime locality for them. So they certainly New England, New York, and mid-Atlantic states. On west through Illinois and Iowa, that's certainly within their range.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks. You know, one of the things I think that I've learned from Phil is that Japanese beetles like to feed where Japanese beetles have fed before them. And so anything that you can do to, if you see them, to get on it right away to reduce that initial damage is good in the long run for having less damage. And it's pretty easy to go out there and just, if you have a can that's got some soapy water in it, if you hold it under where the beetle is, if you just bug them just a little bit, you can't irritate them too much or they'll fly away. But if you just bother them just a little bit, they'll drop off. And so you can, you know, depending on how many plants you have and how many beetles, that may or may not be a good way to take care of the problem. But you know, that is one way to deal with it.
I'm sure another thing Phil always says is that there are people who sell commercial Japanese beetle traps that are baited with floral volatiles. They love flowers, and they love some of the odoriferous compounds that are produced by flowers. And, you can attract a huge number of Japanese beetles with these flower-scented traps. The problem is it doesn't really reduce it brings them into your yard, and it doesn't reduce the number on any plants you're hoping to protect. So they're not usually recommended by people who look into these things.
Hmm. And just on the question of how far north they go, I think there's some kind of deal where if the soil temperature at the level where they overwinter, if it gets cold enough, they can't survive that.
Right. That's why global warming might be a factor, is that if it makes the soil temperatures warmer more northward, then that increases the probability of overwintering. That, you know, the big challenge they face in life is getting through the winter, and they burrow them down in the soil where temperatures are more stable. So if there's not much snow cover, they're at risk of not surviving. Or if it's just an area where the soil is colder further down, they can't find a place to past the winter. So, yeah, so it's why it's hard to predict whether it's going to be a good year or a bad year, because it depends a lot on local soil temperatures and climate conditions.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk with somebody else here, and that would be a caller in Indiana, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I'm interested in if you could give an evaluation of groups that have basically disappeared, and before the program started, I was thinking about over the past, I remember as a child in the late 40s, were what we called stag beetles or rhinoceros beetles and horned beetles, you know, just from the local area, would come out and parade around on the sidewalks, and was part of the thing. That's when I first became interested in insects. I haven't seen any of those in years. Another thing I've noticed, I haven't seen much now that I, when I drive around the country, I'm over by Lafayette, is the Luna moth. I see a few of them every once in a while late at night. Still see a lot of praying mantis, you know, flying about 10 feet over the highways and stuff. But things like the Luna moth and certain kinds of beetles, I wondered if they have, they're gone because of the DDT and the other wonderful things that the farmers use to kill everything, but you know, wheat and corn. I just wondered generally if what groups or particular insects would be very difficult to find. You know, I was thinking along the lines of like people when they go out birding, you know, once a year and find all the different species that are floating around. If there's anything done like that, the entomologists do. And if so, where might be a place on the web I could go to find out, you know, such and such is, you know, in dire straits, ready to, you know, to go away.
Well, funny you should mention it, but there's an organization called the Xerxes Society, which is
dead. Texas?
No, it's actually in Oregon.
Oregon?
X-E-R-C-E-S.
Yeah.
It's a Society for the Preservation of Endangered Invertebrates.
Okay.
And they publish a magazine called Wings.
Okay.
In the most recent issue of Wings is an article about the giant silk moth, the Saturnians, including the Luna moth.
Yeah.
You're not the only one who's noticed that they're harder to find than they used to be.
Gotcha.
And it's not just Lunas. It's all of the big, spectacular, showy moths in this family,
yeah,
including Cecropia and Polyphemus and Emperor moth. These are the just absolutely breathtaking moths that you sometimes find at lights at, you know, sitting on your front doorway. And because they're so beautiful and so impressive, people notice them. I mean, there's so many insects could go extinct and no one would even know because nobody knows they're there. But these guys, people have an interest in, and there are dozens of theories. And among the theories, urbanization has changed the light cycles. These guys depend for all their business, darkness at night and uninterrupted night period for going into diapause for the winter. Another theory is accidental exposure to pesticides, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
But the theory that seems to have the most credence right now, it's kind of surprising. It was not the farmers that may have done them in, but the entomologists that did them in.
Uh-huh.
Way back at the turn of the century, there was an effort, you know, the gypsy moth is an enormous pest of forests. There was an effort to introduce a biological control agent. This is a natural enemy of the gypsy moth that would, you know, so you could not use chemicals to kill these guys, but an enemy that would seek them out and destroy them by eating them. And the enemy they introduced was a parasitic fly called, Compsilura concinnata. It doesn't have a common name.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a fly that lays its eggs inside the body of almost exclusively caterpillars. Now, it liked gypsy moths, but it liked a whole lot of other things. In fact, gypsy moths have only one generation a year, which meant this fly, which had multiple generations a year, needed to attack other caterpillars. And it, sure enough, it attacks the Saturnians. And the general consensus is, although some people will debate it, that maybe it's parasitization by attack from this parasitic fly that, you know, didn't affect much the gypsy moth, but it certainly had done a number on these big, giant, beautiful moths. Which
now, the caterpillar, I'm getting visuals from the past. I've seen one caterpillar some time ago. It had about three or four white, looked like spun.
Those are other kinds of parasites.
Okay.
Those are little, what the caller's talking about, sometimes you'll see a caterpillar and hanging off its back or are little silken, like, bags. And those, each one is a little tiny cocoon of a little tiny wasp.
Yeah.
There are wasps that lay their eggs inside the body of caterpillars, and then when it's time for them to pupate, they burst through the wall, which, of course, is not too good for the caterpillar. In fact, it's lethal.
Yeah.
And then spin their cocoons and emerge and go on their way. So, but the Compsilura is not – those are wasp parasites. This is a fly parasite.
Okay.
Yeah, so – you know, that's one drawback. Biocontrol has many fine attributes, but one drawback is it's a lot harder to pull them in once you release them, because once they're out there, they're out there. So,
I'm surprised someone didn't think about that. Was there some kind of theory that, you know, that they only prey upon a particular...
Oh, no, they knew that they had a broad host range, but this was, we're talking 100 years ago almost.
Oh.
Long before, I mean, this was when the concept was brand new, and... people were frantically, I mean, they were actually desperate because gypsy moths were denuding millions of acres of forest.
I've seen a lot of those photographs from around the turn of the century books showed the gypsy moth. Yeah.
It sounds, if you're in the middle of a gypsy moth infestation in the forest, the dropping of the fecal pellets sounds like rain. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, wow. That's about like those aphids and tulip trees. You
know,
like
yeah.
Green under there. Yeah. Okay, well, I'll get off. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your interest in saving insects.
All right.
Well, I almost majored in it, but I went somewhere else. This is the Xerces. Is that Society?
XERCES, Xerces Society.
Okay, out of Oregon, and their magazine's called Wings.
Yeah, and you can find them on the web.
Okay, well, that's where I'll go. Thanks a lot.
All right,
good luck.
Thank you for the call. We're already past the midpoint here with our guest, May Barenbaum. She's professor of entomology at University of Illinois, also head of the department, and occasionally is here on the program to talk about insects. And again, as I said at the beginning of the program, we try to save extermination questions for another day. When Phil Nixon is here and when May is here, we say, well, let's see if we can try to appreciate insects just because they're really interesting. And the variation is staggering, and to learn about them and how they live their lives is pretty cool. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have some other callers here. I'm going to mention this now. I don't quite know what to make of this, but apparently we had a caller call in and said he lives here in Urbana and was back in California for a class reunion. And met there someone who is described as an eminent bug guy, who exclaimed when he found out that this person, the caller, was from Urbana, where you are from, said that she has, quote, a reputation.
Woo.
Now, I'm really not sure what exactly that means.
I don't know.
A good thing. Oh, apparently it was a good thing. You had a good reputation.
Well, that's a relief.
I don't know if that means, you know, among eminent scientist, she has a good reputation, or what?
But, I would hope so.
I can't imagine that you would have a bad reputation unless you're leading some sort of secret life that the rest of us don't know about. These things do happen.
Oh, not to me, they don't. I mean,
I'm sure we'll be reading about it in the papers. We have a number of callers. Let's see. Let's talk to someone in Decatur. Line number four. Hello. Let's call it there. Line four in Decatur.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, go ahead.
I heard listening at one of these home improvement programs recently, and they were talking about the tent caterpillars, and the caller had made the comment that he hadn't seen as many of the tent nests as he'd seen in the past, and he was wondering if there was some reason for their decline. In my own interest is that I would rather there be an increase in tent caterpillars, because as a birder, I've noticed a considerable decrease over the last 10, 20 years of cuckoos, and I know that they're the one kind of bird that really specializes in tent caterpillars. So is that true that there has been a real decline, and do you know what the cause is?
I'm very impressed, because not many people know. I mean, you'd think that would be a great meal for birds, because there's hundreds in a nest, but they're furry, they're fuzzy, and not many birds will eat fuzzy caterpillars. But cuckoos, you're absolutely right, specialize on fuzzy caterpillars.
Well, it's practically impossible to find a black-billed cuckoo anymore, and even yellow-billed cuckoos, which used to be common along the Sangamon River are much scarcer now.
Yeah, it's I haven't heard of any major population crisis among the tent caterpillars. In fact, in Kentucky, there was an outbreak of spontaneous abortions among very expensive thoroughbreds that had people up in arms. And the again, it's a little controversial, but what seems to be responsible is accidental ingestion of tent caterpillars in the spring when the mares are pregnant. So there certainly was no shortage of tent caterpillars in the past few years in the Kentucky area.
This is the same problem that you said is why most birds don't like to eat them because of their...
The hairs are irritating, yeah.
Irritating.
And there's also some question. A lot of tent caterpillars feed on plants in the Rosaceae, the cherry family, and the foliage of cherries, believe it or not, and the pits of cherries, by the way, and apples and other plants in that family, contain cyanide. So if a caterpillar is full of leaves of cherry trees, it's likely its gut is full of it's called cyanogenic compounds, compounds that release cyanide when they're digested. So that also could be, you know, a cause for a tummy ache and non-preference among foraging birds. There are all kinds of possible reasons. There could be when populations of insects, particularly tree-feeding caterpillars, get too big, then diseases start affecting them, sort of unique to caterpillar-type diseases, which is why a lot of tree-feeding species go in cycles, sort of 10-year cycles, where they'll build up and build up, and then they'll just disappear for a while. Nobody is mourning the passage other than the cuckoo fans, I guess, and the cuckoos themselves. Yeah, there's other furry caterpillars. The fall webworm also makes tent-like structures. They're at the. They're different from the tent caterpillars. It makes them in forks. The fall webworms will make them on edges of, at the termini, the ends of branches, and they're fuzzy as well. So, but I don't know how. That's way past fledging season for the baby cuckoos, so probably wouldn't be out in time to do them any good.
I once saw, this was in the late fall or early winter, saw a number of tents of these things, and there were evening grosbeaks feeding on these things. And apparently, they dig in and they grab that hard little thing that's sort of like a BB, I guess that contains the overwintering.
I think thought they overwintered as eggs, but
anyway, whatever it was, they're apparently small and hard, like BBs. But the grosbeaks are sort of specialized for cracking open things like that. And they seem to be dining on these little bubbles or whatever.
Well, the little hard. I mean, they may be pupae inside cocoons, and they can pick apart the remove the cocoon from the silken web. That birds are just unbelievable. You know, monarchs are poisonous. They store the heart poisons that are in their milkweed hosts, but there's a group of birds, including, I think, orioles, that can – they basically take the caterpillars and squeeze them like toothpaste, which gets rid of the poisons inside the gut and then just gobble them down. So birds have ways of handling, you know, nasty things and avoiding the nastiness.
By the way, I had read that explanation that you gave about the decline of the Luna and the other silkworm moths. It was in the New York Times a couple of years ago, and I was going to ask you about that before this came on.
Well, not everybody believes it. It's hard to prove. I mean, you can certainly demonstrate. You can collect these caterpillars, and you bring them into the laboratory, and flies come out. So you can prove that they're being parasitized, but you can't really actually, you know, conclusively blame them for the decline, because nobody's been doing censuses every year of in a systematic way of the abundance, which they have been doing, by the way, for monarchs. So just a few high-profile, charismatic-type lepidopterans, charismatic caterpillars.
By the way, that guy also asked the question, is there anything analogous to the surveys that birdwatchers do?
Oh, yes, I forgot to mention that.
And... Well, I read in the Springfield paper last year. It was around the 1st of July, so it's pretty close to today's date. But for the last couple of years, they have been doing a census in Mason County because that has such a nice variety of botanical areas, and there's a lot of more different kinds of butterflies than.
Yes, there's an organization called the North American Butterfly Society, NABS, it's called, and it's dedicated to butterfly watching, just like bird watching.
Yes.
So not collecting, but watching. And they publish a number of guidebooks and how-to and, you know, tips on what to bring and where to go and distribution maps and the like. So that's another site on the web to visit.
What's the name of the site then?
It's North American Butterfly Society, NABS.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
We have about 15 minutes left, actually a little bit less, with our guest, Mae Barenbaum, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next, we'll go to Urbana and line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Hi. I'm calling from Urbana at the Bee Research Facility. I'm here with Nadia, Charlie, Adam, and Amy. And we had a question about fireflies. I was outside with my boyfriend, and I noticed that there are some fireflies that come out earlier in the evening, sort of right before it gets dark. And these seem to have very slow light intensity, and the frequency is very slow in terms of the amount of times they actually flash. And then I also noticed that later on there might be, I don't know if it's a subspecies or a different species of fireflies that come out later in the evening when it's much darker, and they seem to be more low to the ground and in the grass, and they have different coloration. I was just kind of curious about the fireflies in this area and, you know, what you had to say about them.
Well, I'm actually glad you asked, because before I came over here, I got a call from Tom Rogers, who works here at WILL, wondering about fireflies. And I told him, hey, listen to Focus 580, and you can find out. And fortunately, somebody did call to ask. And there was a very entomological observation to notice that, in fact, the color frequency varies, the flash frequency varies, the height in vegetation varies, and the timing of flight varies. Because these are all sort of ways to ensure this, that the members of the same species can signal to each other most efficiently. And there are a few species of fireflies in the area. The most common one is the, I think it's called, the common name is Pennsylvania firefly. It's Photinus pennsylvanicus, I think, is what it's called. But the what distinguishes the species is the flash pattern. Females and males of different species have different flash patterns, and females have different response behaviors. The most notorious of the fireflies, of course, is our species in the genus Photurus, and they're called the femme fatale fireflies because they will respond to any male's flash. And it's not that they're promiscuous, it's that they're carnivorous. So they'll flash in response to a male's signal, and the usual routine is male flash, females flash back and forth. The females sort of lie low in vegetation, and the males fly, and they'll fly in, and then, that's it for him. It's lights out for the males there. It's kind of a mystery, actually. People know what Photurus females eat. That's other fireflies. But not so much what other adult fireflies eat. It's kind of, it's not clear. They have biting mouth parts. The immatures, the immature fireflies, are sometimes those that are luminescent are called glowworms, eat earthworms and snails and slugs. And that's why, in answer to Tom Rogers' question, it's likely that they're early and abundant this season because we've had a fairly wet spring. And wet springs are very good for earthworms, slugs, and snails. So if it's good for slugs and snails, it's good for fireflies, and that improves the survival through the childhood and consequently a lot of adults. And they are a little early this year. To me, it seems they're early. So I don't know if I left anything out. for the if you're really interested, one thing I just came across is there's some new information solving a mystery. Well, maybe solving the mystery of how they shut the lights off. I mean, it's a big deal to flash a particular pattern, particularly because it's not like turning a light switch. This is a chemical reaction that makes that glow.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to control the chemistry, and it involves a substrate called a chemical that's transformed called luciferin, an enzyme that works on that, and chemical fuel. That's what makes it, they convert the chemical energy into light energy, and it needs oxygen too. And it turns out that the cells that produce this light, they're called photocytes or light cells,
mm-hmm.
aren't connected to nerve cells. So how do you, it's like, how do you have a light switch without electricity? And it turns out there's a substance which you guys at the B-Lab know very well, a neurotransmitter. That's a signal substance that lets nerve cells talk to other cells.
Right.
Nitrous oxide apparently is produced. It only lasts a very short time, but what it does is it shuts down the energy machine in the cell, the mitochondria, which suck up oxygen to make energy. And you need oxygen for the light. So as long as there's nitrous oxide,
mm-hmm.
Then the mitochondria aren't sucking up oxygen. The oxygen's there to power the reaction, and it lights up. As soon as the NO degrades, the lights go out. So it's kind of like...
I'm sorry. Do you happen to know what part of the brain actually controls this?
No, that I don't know. But I will look it up. And this is like cutting-edge new stuff here on Fireflies. Although the popular press had a lot of fun with it because the compound nitrous oxide is abbreviated as NO. So it's like, no kidding, no fooling, yeah, no way. So anyway, way, I guess. And that's the latest on Fireflies.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. I hope Tom's got all that down. It's like a graduate seminar here every day. People better be taking notes. Let's go to the next caller, and that would be line 3. Hello.
Yeah, hello. Mm-hmm. Thank you for taking my call. I'll try to make this brief since you're come to the close of your program. Have an inhabitant in the basement. Looks like a jumping cricket, except it makes no sound. It has 6 legs with the 2 rear. I've got a dried specimen in front of me here, so I'll describe this as best as I can. It has the 2 hopper legs in the back are kind of banded with black and kind of yellowish, orangish kind of look. And then at the very end of those hopper legs where they contact, it has a little bit of a fluke, hairy pattern coming off their hopper legs. The whole thing measures about 1 inch, although we've had specimens larger and smaller. And they, they jump and they hop and they seem to end up in our base and sink. Any ideas as to what these are?
They have really, really long antennae?
I can't see. Oh, there's, the antenna is about as long as
the body?
One of the, as long as the mm-hmm. body. And they're about as long as the some of the legs in the front. Although those rear jumping legs are, specifically for purpose, and they're much longer than the others. Also has a projection from its proboscis. From its tail end,
right.
That's about the length of the body as well, and it comes to a tapered point. Can you tell me what that is, please?
It sounds a lot like a camel cricket. They're in a different family from your typical crickets. They're in the gorilla crittids, and they have this typical, typically they're humpback. They have these very long antennae, yep. Great big legs with stripes on them.
Uh-huh.
There's cave crickets, camel crickets are all in this, in this group. What species you have, a little hard to say, but they love basements. Otherwise, they're very cricket-like. That long projection off the tail end,
mm-hmm.
kind of amusing. A lot of people assume that that's the male because it's a long structure at the tail, in the abdomen, but actually that's the female. And that's used as an ovipositor, an egg-laying substance. They deposit their eggs in the soil, so they need to have a digging device to guide the eggs into the soil. So it sounds a lot like a camel cricket.
C-A-M-E-L?
Yeah, like the, humpback camel. So
yes, oh, right, exactly.
Yeah. So if you go on the web and look up camel cricket or cave cricket, you might be able to...
Lastly, if you have time, what are they eating down there?
Generally, these guys are opportunistic feeders on just about... anything that's that is they can find, and they'll eat decaying vegetation, or some of them will take in insects, plant roots, whatever they can find in the soil. Some actually are cannibals and will eat each other.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Well, you know what? We're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say, and we have some callers we can't take. In fact, one of them says we should have May on more often.
Okay,
and
by me.
We think so too. So maybe next month you come back and we do it again.
Happy to.
All right. In the meantime, if you're interested in reading about insects, you can go to the library, go to the bookstore, and look for some of her books, like the famous 99 Gnats, Nits, and Nibblers, and 99 more Maggots, Mites, and Munchers, which are pretty funny. And if you have children who are interested in bugs, that might be a nice thing for them. Or you could look for her book, Bugs in the System, Insects and Their Impact on Human Affairs. She's head of the Department of Entomology here at U of I. Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
The broadcast today made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, imported foods from Europe, the Middle East, India, and around the world. Food tastings held every Saturday from 11 to 5. World Harvest Foods at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign encourage you to join them in supporting public radio. You may be aware of the outstanding support that we received during our April and October pledge drives here at WILL. And we think that that is an indication of the value listeners place on the programs that we have on the station. However, our fund drives raise just about a third of our total listener support contributions. We are now coming down to the end of our fiscal year. We have less than a week, and we are still short of our June 30th goal. And right now that number is $86,900. That's how much we still need to raise. And now we have less than a week to do it. If we're going to maintain the quality and the variety of the programs that you value in the coming fiscal year, well, we need your support. If you've never made a contribution before, we'd like to hear from you now. If you are already a supporter and you can give us a little bit more, well, that would be nice too. So what you can do is call us at 217-244-9455. You can call right now with a renewal, an additional gift, first-time gift, whichever. Again, it's 217-244-9455. If you're online, you can go to our website, and that's WILL.UIUC.edu, and that way you can make a credit card contribution. Or if you get it in the mail right away, you can send us a check. Make it out to UIF WILL Radio, 300 North Goodwin Avenue in Urbana, and that's 61801. However you do it, we hope that you will do that before the end of the fiscal year, and that's just less than a week away now. Your support, very important to the station. We're going to take a break. We'll have some news and update on the markets. Then we'll be talking with Stephen Batchelor. He's a former Buddhist monk in the Zen and Tibetan traditions, and we'll talk about his book, Living with the Devil, which is a consideration of the problem of evil from a Buddhist point of view. Right now, though, the markets. Stay tuned.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
Here with this update on the markets at 10:59. Good morning, I'm Jay Pierce.